Well, good morning. It's good to be in the Lord's house with you today. If you would turn to Psalm 139 this morning. I want to thank you again for asking us to be here and for the kindness you showed. We were driving back to the hotel last night and talking about how nice everyone in the church is. And one of the girls said, "It's because we're in the South." And I said, "Yeah, but there's a little more to it than that." Psalm 139, the text is going to be verses 13 through 16, but I just wanted to describe to you what the psalmist is doing leading up to that, so you get a contextual view of the psalm. It's a psalm of David praising God's sovereignty in a couple of ways. We praise God's sovereignty and praise Him for what we would call His transcendence. He is far above. His thoughts are not like our thoughts. He is higher than us. And that's the idea of being transcendent. And yet, also in the psalm, He's praised for what we would call eminence. He is close to us. He's right there with us. God is both transcendent and eminent. He's very close. And in this closeness, David is praising God's sovereignty. Verses 1 through 6 essentially describe that God knows all things. So, for example, look at verses 1 and 2. "O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar." Though He is transcendent, He still knows all things about us. So, verses 1 through 6 is God knows all things. In verses 7 through 12, it is God is with us in all places. So, for example, look at verse 7. "Where shall I go from your spirit?" Or, "Where shall I flee from your presence?" Right? There's no place you can go that God is not also imminent. He's right there with you. Then, so going from He knows all things to He is in all places, starting in our text in verse 13, sort of moving forward, David is talking about how God is with us at all times. So look at verse 13 through 16. "For you formed me," "you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them." Now, let me say, as I begin this message addressing another issue, and the issue this morning is the issue of abortion, I do not make any assumptions about who is in the room this morning. I fully expect that today I am speaking to a woman who has sought to hide her shame by secretly having an abortion in the past, a man who, in order to cater to his own convenience, has quietly coerced a woman into having an abortion, a woman or man who is presently facing pressure to be free kind of from a life of consequences of bringing a child into the world. I know as a fact there are some among us who, by God's grace, are only here because they've successfully survived a botched abortion attempt. And I'm certain there are grandmothers and grandfathers who have been robbed of the blessing of a lost generation, and other grandparents who might have advised or even given permission for the aborting of an inconvenient life. Statistically speaking, since all of us know someone who has died of cancer, we likely know the reality of abortion is almost twice as many lives are lost by abortion in the U.S. every year than are to cancer. About 1 million per year at this point. So just based on the statistics, I'm sure that within your church families, there are people who have faced or are facing, or may soon face, the easily accessible choice of ending a child's life. This is not a theoretical issue. It is real to us. It's close to us. And so I'm so thoroughly convinced that abortion is sin, that abortion is in fact the murder of a child, that if it were in my power, I would immediately make it illegal everywhere. As I'm sure you know, overturning the Roe versus Wade decision did not change the status of abortion laws anywhere. While I am very glad that Alabama is not like Illinois, right? That in Alabama, you've enacted some of the strictest abortion laws in the nation since the overturning of Roe versus Wade, you still must be diligent going forward. To echo the words of a pro-life activist named Abby Johnson, our goal is not to simply make abortion illegal. Our goal is to make abortion unthinkable. To that end, here's what you should expect from the message this morning. First, we're going to have a very brief review of this text, the meaning here, which shows that God not only knows, but He purposefully designs all life in the womb. Then we'll address some logical fallacies accepted by those who support abortion. Then we'll see how God's Word affirms the humanity, the personhood of unborn life. And finally, just recommend some practical steps to take regarding abortion. Let's look at this text again, verses 13 through 16 of Psalm 139. For you formed my inward parts. You knitted me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written, every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them. I want to begin with our text this morning to describe God's purpose with unborn life. The psalmist, in this case David, is writing a song to describe that sovereignty, that transcendence and immanence of God. In this specific section, he's agreeing that the power and the purpose of God extends to all places at all times, including the realm of preborn life. He does it in such a unique way. Really, when you dig into this, it seems kind of odd at first. There's this phrase, "You have formed my inward parts." If you look at that in Hebrew and you translate it very literally, it is, "You made my kidneys." Now, of course, God made more than just David's kidneys, right? He made all of David. But the reason why, poetically, David is using this Hebrew word for kidneys is because that, at the time, was considered to be sort of the seat of emotion in Old Testament culture. That is where feelings were thought to come from. Proverbs, for example, speaks of kidneys rejoicing. When you move forward to the New Testament uses a word for bowels because bowels is where we thought emotions came from. Now, just to know, we know better than this, right? Where do your emotions and feelings come from? Yeah, they come from your heart. Except, of course, your left ventricle has nothing literally to do with how you feel. This is just our way of expressing where emotions come from. At some point far in the future, someone might say, "I love you from the bottom of my spleen," because that's what they think emotions come from. David is just using this word kidneys because in his culture, that was sort of the seat of emotions. And so what he's saying is he's using this word to describe his emotions, his feelings, to say that God created those very things. Now please sort of file that in the back of your mind for tomorrow, because that's going to be important tomorrow. The next phrase, "You knitted me together in my mother's womb," he is, again, poetically picturing God going to work, the womb of a pregnant woman, is the place where God knits together or weaves this growing life. As David was a fetus growing in the womb of his mother, that growth didn't happen in some haphazard fashion. He was being knit together by the masterful hand and the sovereign power of the Creator God. And all of this is a cause for praise. He says in verse 14, I praise you. Why? Because the life of that unborn child, he says, it's cause for fear, right? I'm fearfully made. This is cause for fear, this reverential awe that ought to result, knowing that this is what God has done. It's a cause for wonder. It's a miracle to marvel at. And David adds, my soul knows it very well. Even the eternal soul of David was a unique creation of God. And David says that soul turns in wonder to rejoice and glory in the knowledge of its Creator. Now, think about what David has done in these verses as he describes himself forming. Let me just ask you this. What is the description biblically of a righteous life? How do you live righteously? Well, Jesus said, it's to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. To love God supremely with every part of you that makes you, you. Right? All of it is to worship and love God. And so what David has done here is shown us how that God, who commands glory from every part of our being, is the very Creator God who made every part of our being. Right? You knitted me together. You made me physically. You made my kidneys, this place of emotions, these inward parts. You made my feelings. My soul knows very well your wonderful works, because God is the Creator of this soul. All parts were made for the glory of God. All your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. Or maybe allow me to say it this way. An unborn child is not just a clump of cells in the eyes of God. An unborn child is purposefully designed and personally known by God. That unborn child is going to touch physically because God made him for that purpose. That unborn child is going to feel emotionally because God made her to feel. The unborn child is going to think reasonably because God made his mind to think. The child's greatest potential is found in a soul that praises and acknowledges her Creator forever. This unborn child is more than just a clump of cells. God himself is pictured here as the skillful weaver, an expert architect, the masterful designer of the life in the womb. And so, abortion is the willing destruction of a living masterpiece created by God's own hand. It is the murder of a life that was purposefully designed and personally known to God. In fact, not only is that unborn life a masterpiece of God's creation, we also know that every child born into this world is made in the image of God. What it means in full detail to be made in the image of God is a complicated and detailed study, and I'm going to leave that for Todd and Brian and Jacob to deal with over the course of months and months. But I'm going to offer you a very simplified explanation of why it matters. God is not indifferent to abortion. Imagine that I came into your house today and proceeded to mock and ridicule your character, to rebel against your home's rules, and then because it seemed like a convenient thing to me, I went through the house vandalizing and destroying every picture that includes you or your family that looks like you. Would that matter to you? Wouldn't you be insulted by that? Then no doubt the destruction of God's unique creation, especially those parts of creation that were made in his image, that represent his image, is an insult to him. And abortion does exactly that. It is vile in the eyes of God. And yet our society has promoted this insult in the name of convenience. And many of us have turned a blind eye as it happened. Be certain, God is not blind to it. He sees what we don't see. In verse 15, David says, "My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret." Right? He goes on in verse 16 to say that even though he was imperfect, that is incomplete, God's eyes saw him, and every part created that made David to be David were recorded in the ledger of his Creator even when they were still being made. Even before that child's own eyes developed, before it ever opened eyes outside of the womb, verse 16 makes it very clear that the ever watchful eyes of God the Father were on that child. God sees this infant in the womb as a person with emotions, senses, a purpose, and a soul. So on what basis does society remove that personhood from an unborn child? God sees this fetus as a child. And so perhaps the argument would be that those who don't believe in God, those who reject all things spiritual and supposedly they embrace science instead, those people have an argument for denying an unborn child the status of a person. Although in reality, they don't. Even some of the simplest logic would argue that an unborn child is human life worthy of protecting. Just on a logical level, this is where an argument can be won or lost. If that entity in the mother's womb is merely a fetus, right? Some scientifically defined mass of blood and tissue, then abortion is doing nothing wrong. But if that is a person, if it is a child, if it's a baby, then clearly killing it crosses the moral line. The questions between the pro-life and pro-choice debate can get so muddled in a thousand different directions when the two sides start yelling at each other and never listening to one another. However, it's going to prove fruitless if we don't keep it focused on a simple question. Are we talking about a person, and why would we identify this as a person? God, who is the ultimate authority, says that it's a person, and that's what we rely on. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But even applying simple human logic, the personhood of an unborn child is firmly established. There's a fellow named Scott Klusendorf, who's the president of Life Training Institute. He makes a very good argument for this. He writes that the issue can be brought down to what he sees as a single point by using what he's termed as toddler tactics. Essentially, if we take any of the reasoning for allowing abortion and apply it to a toddler instead of an unborn child, we're going to see it really becomes an issue of definition, right? Is that a child? It's whether or not that's a child makes something right or wrong. So for example, a common argument is, well, a woman has a right to privacy in these kinds of decisions. Well, okay. Is it okay to kill a toddler in private? Obviously not. A toddler is a person even when it's behind closed doors, even when it's done privately. Some would say it's a question of affordability, right? Some families opt for abortion because they simply can't afford fitting this ever-expanding costs of having children into their budget. Would it be okay, though, for some family in hard economic times to eliminate some expenses by putting a couple of their toddlers to death? No, a child is a person. Even if its parents are poor, it's still a person. What if the child's not wanted? Well, first off, it is wanted somewhere. But even if not, we would never apply the same standard to a child who's already been born. After all, it doesn't become more or less wanted just because it's been born. Let's say there's a three-year-old toddler in a family, and turns out that family doesn't want that kid anymore. By the time he's five, let's say he's going to be physically and mentally abused, at what point does it make it okay to kill him? A child doesn't stop being a person because they're wanted or unwanted, because they're treated well or treated badly. Some would say, well, what if it's going to be born with disabilities? After all, at this point, medical science can somewhat accurately predict mental and physical disabilities. But if we had some, you know, two-year-old girl here who was mentally disabled, she can't walk, she can't talk, she's never going to be able to do either. We look at her, she's not an attractive kid to look at. Is it okay for me to smother her with a pillow and just spare that child her ongoing existence and me the inconvenience of having to look at her? Even the most extreme arguments, when you sort of use toddler tactics, for, you know, I'm sure you've heard the question, well, what if we're talking about a woman who has been raped? Shouldn't she be allowed to have an abortion? Well, how should a civil society treat innocent human beings who remind us of a painful event? If a woman came to you today and said, here is my child, he's the product of rape, first off, your heart should break for her. You should feel for these people. That little boy looks like his father. It reminds her of the horrible experience every waking moment. She's afraid he's going to grow up to be just like her attacker was. You would have a great deal of compassion, but what you would never do, what you would never say is, okay, hand him over and I'll go grab a knife. A person, even a person who reminds you of horrible experiences, is still a person. There are better options available. By the way, just to give you the statistic, less than 1% of abortions are performed due to rape or abuse. So it is a statistically irrelevant argument. 6% are because of potential medical problems with the child. And as far as the infamous, well, what about saving the life of a mother? Former Surgeon General C. Everett Koop said his entire career, he had never encountered that situation. The vast majority of abortions, about 93%, fall into the category of social reasons. The child would be too expensive, the child's unwanted, the child's inconvenient, the child is embarrassing. And so that becomes the real question. It doesn't matter whether it's wanted or not, if the mother can afford it or not, if it has disabilities or not, if it's the product of rape even. If it's just tissue, you're fine to get rid of it. But if it's a child, it has a right to live. It's morally wrong to kill. And everything else becomes irrelevant. When the debate about abortion sort of descends into questions about compassion and convenience and disabilities and economics, it has already entirely missed the point. That's not to say that we don't have compassion for people who are facing those experiences. Listen, I don't want to violate anyone's privacy. I don't want for them to be needlessly inconvenienced. I don't want to inflict pain and suffering. But ultimately, all those issues fade away if we simply ask, is that a clump of cells? Or is this a living human being? Is this a person? And so let's try to answer that question just again, scientifically, logically for a moment. Unborn children at the earliest stages of development have all the genetic material necessary for humanity. The smallest particles of life, which we now understand, would essentially be the DNA code. And it is included in our cellular system. Within that code, we have all the parts of a working human, from the color of their hair to a propensity for a certain kind of talent in areas, the likelihood of specific diseases, right? We know a lot from the genetic code. In fact, if you gave a DNA scientist the smallest cells of life, they would be able to identify what its genus is, what its species is. They would say this is human. They would be able to say specific characteristics about the individual whom that DNA came from. They would say this not knowing whether it came from me or from you or from an unborn child 2 days after it was conceived. It's that code which sort of starts this human life on the remarkable journey through its first 9 months. Within moments of fertilization, the gender of a child is a foregone conclusion. That brings up a different debate, but we're going to have to talk about it tomorrow. In the first few weeks, the neural tubes are formed, setting the foundation for thought and senses and all feelings. A heartbeat begins in the fifth week. Arms and legs start to appear. By the seventh week, there's eyes and ears and nose and mouth and fingers and toes. They're forming. They're clearly distinguishable. By week 11, almost all organs are not only formed, but they're operating. And by the 14th week, babies can be seen in 4D sonograms to be sucking their thumbs. By the time a child is only about halfway through a normal pregnancy, it has developed the cells needed for taste, smell, hearing, sight, touch. He or she will kick, punch, wibble. They will calm when they hear familiar sounds in the womb, like music or voices. They'll be startled and jump when they hear unexpected sounds and loud noises. Our society is so strange that at this point, if it was an eagle egg, it would be illegal to destroy it if it had just been laid and is nothing more inside except a yolk and some goo, because eagles are a protected species. We want them. Nobody argues an eagle egg isn't an eagle yet. Right? It's just given that status because if left to natural processes, an eagle is what it's going to be. And yet an unborn child, with all the genetic code for humanity, with heart and lungs and fingers and toes and eyes and ears and nose, who can think and feel and suck its thumb and be comforted and be frightened, it is deemed inhuman until the moment that it's born. The difference is only that someone will stand up and say they want that eagle to exist in the world, but no one is standing up to say they want that child. Someone say, oh, well, no, that's not it. It's just not a person until it's born. Why? Why would we ever think that? It reacts like a person. It feels like a person. What standard do we use that it's not? The only standard that society is using is, you know, is this a person? Is the question, do you want that child? Even in the most liberal states, all of them have laws recognizing an unborn child as a person. In Illinois, for example, which is about as liberal a state as you can find, killing an unborn child is a felony. It even defines in that law what an unborn child is. It is any individual of the human species from embryo until birth. And so ending the life of that child is a criminal felony unless you are, quote, the pregnant individual whose unborn child is killed. In other words, an unborn child is a child from the moment of conception, and it is illegal to harm that child unless you happen to be that child's mother and you don't want it. In which case, it magically turns into a clump of cells and is disposable. It's entirely irrational. Stephen Schwartz, in his book, The Moral Question of Abortion, discounts the four main arguments against the humanity of an unborn child. Here are the arguments that you'll usually hear. The first one is about size and appearance, because some would argue that an unborn child is simply, it's too small to assign humanity to. After all, at some stages of development that I just listed, that baby is still like just an inch or two long. So it's too small for it to be considered human. However, that argument doesn't stand to reason. Men are generally bigger than women. Does that make men more human than women? In fact, I dare say I'm probably bigger than all of you in here this morning. It doesn't mean that I'm more of a person than you. The size and appearance of an individual is not a determining factor in whether or not this counts as a person. And some would say, well, no, it's the level of development, right? Some would argue the stage of development. It's just too early. It's too new. We can't call that human yet. We can't call it a person yet. It's just not a person because it's not fully developed. Do we somehow forfeit rights when we aren't as developed? Just think about this. A 14-year-old is more developed than a 2-year-old. That doesn't mean that the teenager is more of a real person with more rights. Humans don't become disposable because they're underdeveloped or helpless or defenseless or dependent. Humans require protection when they're underdeveloped and helpless and dependent. Some would say, well, it's the environment, right? It's about a change of locations. And this one, I've never really understood this one. The birth process from the woman's womb to the outside world is a geographical change of about 8 or 9 inches. Nothing magic is happening in the birth canal that makes it come out different from what it was on the inside. In fact, a doctor would be convicted of murder if it took a newly born child and killed it, but somehow it's okay if he reaches inside, cuts it in pieces, and sucks it out with a vacuum. A change of locations like that is a morally trivial argument on whether or not this is a person. And the fourth one's the degree of dependency. The difference, some would argue, is that the unborn child is dependent in such a degree to its mother that the mother's choice of her own self-determination supersedes the child's right to life. But a baby, and by that I mean a child who has been born, an infant that's a month, 2 months old, there is never a point at which that thing is not still dependent. When does a baby stop being totally dependent? It's totally dependent at a day old, at a week old, at a month old. 1 year olds are not independent, right? They're still dependent on someone. If that is the standard that we're going to set, then it also supports infanticide, just murdering infants. Or what about when someone is older and they become dependent, right? They become dependent on insulin or nitroglycerin. Does the same logic work? Like if you know someone who got COVID, went to the hospital, was put on a ventilator, did they become less human in the process of becoming more dependent? We might be dependent on others for our survival, but we are never dependent on others for our value. Dependent people are people. And so logically, we have every reason to include an unborn child in the definition of valuable humanity that deserves to be protected. Any argument to exclude them from personhood fails just based on logic. Is it a person? Yeah, an unborn baby, that's a person. However, we are not exclusively limited to the scope of human logic and philosophy when it comes to answering this question. The single defining authority is God Himself and His Word, and it makes several statements that are clear about the personhood of unborn children. I want you to consider some of them this morning. God sees our start as being in the womb. Job 31, verse 15. Job asks rhetorically, "Did not He who made me in the womb make him? And did not one fashion us in the womb?" right? Now think of this. Where was Job made? Job was made in the womb. He wasn't baking. He wasn't a bun in the oven. He wasn't preparing to be made. Job says he was fashioned in the womb. He was made in the womb. And this applies to all people because that verse, Job is specifically pointing to the equality of other people based on God's design before they were born. Job, in chapter 31, is talking about servants and how he was respectful towards his servants, towards those people who were not considered as good as him, is not considered as high as him. And so this is, again, this is what he said. Did not he, that is God, who made me in the womb, make him, the servants? And did not one fashion us in the womb? David says in our original text in Psalm 139, he was made in secret where no one could see but God. He was fearfully and wonderfully made. In fact, he describes in verse 16 of Psalm 139 that God sees us for who we are even before we are fully developed, because that development is according to his design. He sees our unformed substance, our body parts, even when they're incomplete, and there aren't any of them yet. In fact, up in the state of Illinois, their laws are actually echoing the Old Testament law of God. Please, don't go up there and tell them that. They will change them immediately if they realize this. Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 and 23 says, when men strive together and hit a pregnant woman so that her children come out, but there is no harm, the one who hit her shall surely be fined, as the woman's husband shall impose on him, he shall pay as the judges determine. But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life. This is God's own version of manslaughter, or reckless homicide of an unborn child. If you cause a woman to go into premature labor and her child survives, that law says, well, you're going to pay a monetary fine. But if you have killed that child in the process, the fine is the same as if you have killed a person. Because that child is a person, even though it wasn't born yet. And you are guilty of murder. Job, who said, didn't the same God make us all in the womb? And David, who claimed to be fearfully and wonderfully made, they do not picture a God who is passive about these things. They picture God in an active role in the development and growth of a child. God claims that child as his own special creation, and it must not be tampered with. That unborn child is a masterwork of God, and the development of that child is to be left in the hands of God, as he is the only one with authority to advance it or to hinder it. Also, a baby in a womb is personally known to God. Jeremiah speaks of this in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5. God, in calling the prophet Jeremiah, says, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you and appointed you a prophet to the nations. You understand what the Lord is saying there? Not only does it repeat the previous point that the Lord is the one who controls the formation and the development of a child, but it also is designating that God looks at an unborn baby and sees its purpose and its potential and his plan for its entire life. Jeremiah, before you were even born, I had a plan for your life. And so what is God's answer to, is this a person? In the Bible, God speaks of those unborn children in a very personal way. They have personalities. They have wants, they have desires and gladness and even jealousies. Remember, in our text, David describes that he was made with emotions and senses and an eternal soul. Genesis 25, verse 22, it tells the story of Rebekah's pregnancy with twin boys, Jacob and Esau. You remember what happened as she was pregnant? Genesis 25, 22 says, the children struggled together within her. Any of y'all have a brother? Brothers fight, right? It's what brothers do. And these two brothers, even though they were not born yet, they're described as striving together, struggling together in Rebekah's womb, in their mother's womb, by saying the children struggled together within her. That is the common Old Testament term for a word, for a child. Not clumps of blood and goo struggled together within her, right? Actual children struggling together. The same thing happens in the New Testament, by the way. Look at Luke chapter 1. And as you jump there, let me just ask, what would our modern society recommend to a teenage girl who turns up pregnant? She is unmarried, yet she is engaged, and the fiancé is not the baby's father, and he is extremely disturbed by this turn of events. Is there any hope of a fulfilled life? Well, I hope so, because we know that girl. Her name's Mary, and you can read all about her child in the Gospels. And so this, in Luke 1, is a time where the secretly pregnant Mary shows up at the home of her cousin Elizabeth, and Elizabeth is also pregnant with a child who would come to be John the Baptist. And listen to what happens when these two pregnant women meet. Luke chapter 1, start at verse 41. And when Elizabeth heard the greeting of Mary, the baby leaped in her womb. And Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit, and she exclaimed with a loud voice, "Blessed are you among women, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. And why is this granted to me that the mother of my Lord should come to me?" This is a wonderful occurrence here. These two pregnant women who are being described in this scene are not the only people in this scene, right? Elizabeth is older and she's pregnant with John the Baptist. Mary, her young cousin, is pregnant with Jesus. And those two mothers, when they see each other, are happy to see one another. By the way, a mother is a person who has a child. Jesus is Mary's first child. And she, not having given birth yet, is already called a mother. These two mothers are happy to see one another. And yet it sure seems like the unborn children are happy as well, doesn't it? The description is that John leaped in her womb, apparently excited to be in the presence of Jesus, who was also in the womb. And incidentally, the word for baby that gets used here is the Greek word brephos, and it's exactly the same word that's used when Jesus is born and the baby is wrapped in swaddling clothes and laid in a manger. Also, over in Luke 18, verses 15 and 16, the same word gets used when it says that they were bringing infants to him that he might touch them, and when the disciples saw it, they rebuked him, and Jesus called to them, saying, "Let the children come to me and do not hinder them, for to such belongs the kingdom of God." They were bringing infants to Jesus. Brephos, babies. There are Greek words for unborn children. We use some of those scientifically today. And yet the New Testament writers choose the word brephos, baby, child. Just like a child after it's born. God's word clearly shows that an unborn child is seen as a person. We have no basis in denying that unborn children enjoy all the qualities of humanity and should be treated as possessing personhood and a right to life equal to the rest of humanity. And so, just as a matter of practical application, as Christians, what are we to do? Well, first, I would encourage you to be lovingly outspoken on the issue of abortion. Be clear, being silently pro-life is not being pro-life. Our abortion-supporting society would be content if all the people who believed and accepted that unborn children are worth protecting, they would be content if we would all just shut up. I would encourage you to be outspoken, kindly, lovingly outspoken. Back home, many of our church members participate in a group called 40 Days for Life, just taking time to make a public stand against abortion. That time is not wasted. If you have an opportunity to discuss abortion with friends and family or coworkers, do it. Listen, I know what the laws in Alabama are. I also know they might not be that way forever, and the Florida and Georgia lines are not that far away. If you want a copy of this message to use as a helpful starting point, I'd be glad to give it to you. But I'm going to stress again, be lovingly outspoken. Second, find a way to support foster and adoptive care. Christians have been accused of being so focused on this issue about protecting unborn children that somehow we forget the value of life of children after they're born. The accusation that's made is essentially, you only care about that child until they're born, and then you stop caring and it becomes somebody else's problem. That is a great condemnation to us if we allow it to be true. I know being foster or adoptive parents is not everyone's calling, but at the very least, I would encourage you, do not dismiss it outright. Seek God's guidance in prayer about whether or not it is your calling. And even if it's not your calling, you can still find ways of being supportive of foster and adoptive families. Third, you can engage in the support and training for mothers who have chosen life. It would be the height of hypocrisy if we claim to value life, but we will not support and value the life of those young mothers with just as much compassion and concern as we do their unborn children. I assume y'all have some sort of life-affirming groups here. Like back home, they're called a Women's Pregnancy Center. We have an Empower Life Center. Most places have those. The danger is as abortion becomes restricted in places like Alabama, Planned Parenthoods are put out of business, and then the places that are designed to combat Planned Parenthood also get ignored and go away. You should not let that happen. We should seek ways to help these women and to heal their souls and to bear their burdens and to do it in a gospel-centric mindset. As we promote life for unborn children, remember, we're called to proclaim the eternal life that can only be found in Jesus Christ, God's Son. Fourth, support public officials who are pro-life and proactive about it. Not just in word, but actually in deed. The Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade has not done what many people expected it to do. It simply took a fight from this sort of consolidated level at the federal level and broke it into 50 individual fights that have to continually be fought. Don't assume that the battle is over. And fifth, if you know someone who is considering abortion, lovingly plead with them, beg with them to reconsider. There are other options available. And in the process, don't be so foolish as to pretend that those options are easy. Those options are not easy. Keeping a child is a difficult decision. It's not going to give them a simple road. Giving up a child for adoption has to be a heartbreaking and agonizing decision. Don't pretend that it's not. But having the conversation can be hard, especially, you know, when they haven't asked for your advice. The easy thing to do is say, well, you know, that isn't my business. Don't for a moment think that. It is as much your duty to intervene as if you knew someone was plotting the murder of their toddler. There's really no difference in the value of that life. So use your words to sow hope in their life. Use whatever means are at your disposal to assure them that you will help and actually follow through and be there to help when they need it. Most importantly, point them to the precious Son of God who can give their life and their child's life its eternal purpose and joy. And after you've done that, if you've pleaded with them and they have ignored you and they have gone forward and had an abortion, your job is not done. The person dealing with that is going to be having a tremendous amount of guilt. Whether or not they will admit to it, it is clear that abortion causes a sense of guilt. And it is at that point also that you need to express to them the forgiveness that is found in Jesus Christ. Finally, the absolute greatest tool we have is prayer. If we've learned anything about God and ourselves, I think it would be that He can do anything, and even when we can do nothing. He's able to do everything. He can and will intervene in situations we can't. And so pray for our nation and our states, because God can turn the hearts of our leaders, and pray for those leaders that God's going to convict them of this truth and give them the courage to follow through on those convictions. Pray for those unborn children, because God is transcendent and is imminent and is sovereign, and He can protect them through seemingly impossible means that we never would have thought of. Pray for those considering abortion, because only God can instill in them the kind of self-sacrificial love that their child needs. And pray for the opportunity and courage for yourself to be used by God to intervene in the life of that child and in the life of that child's mother and the life of that child's father for His own glory, pointing them always to Jesus Christ, the perfect Son of God, who can give them wholeness, completeness, purpose, and joy. Okay, thank you.